the radio program that quite literally moves you. Siren 107.3 FM.
And today the role of Julie Corden is being played by Joy Knight and Judith Hibbert. Hurrah! I can hear you all say, because it's Judith's first time in the Siren studios after being a regular co-presenter in all manner of ways. Are you well, Judith?
I'm very well, thanks, Alex.
Marvellous.
Yeah, nice to be here.
It's been a full day, hasn't it?
It certainly has.
Lincolnshire show, hurrah! New jingles for Siren recorded, hurrah! England winning, hurrah!
My best yet.
I had not been aware. I've seen you perform with Danny LaRue, John Pertwee, well, not with John Pertwee, but obviously legendary with all sorts of things. I wasn't aware how excited you could get whilst watching a football match.
Yeah, I haven't got any nails left, but there you go.
Oh, my word. And Malcolm Tomlinson with us again. How are you, Malcolm?
Extremely good, Alex, thank you.
Wonderful stuff. And sharing the microphone, but sharing our hearts as always, join us. How are you, Joy?
I'm very well, thanks, Alex.
Fantastic. And we've even got Aaron Craig, who'll probably have a few words to say, because Aaron is loving the whole Lincoln experience so much that he's decided to come back again and just not go away, really. So that's great. I think it's all there's an angle poise there, Joy, so if you move it up and down, it'll all work properly on that basis.
I don't know.
It's all right. Malcolm will work through the thing wonderfully well. Now, we've had the excitement in terms of the show, in terms of how things are going and sorted through. If I actually take the fabulous world of, yes, the Middlesbrough Literary Festival, because after all we were celebrating the Lincoln Literary Festival a wee while ago, and I turn to page 8 of the brochure, what do I see, Malcolm?
Oh, on page 8, mm-hmm. I'll put my reading glasses on.
Oh, dear.
Almost certainly something to do with a chap called Tim Moulton.
There is, absolutely. You know, yeah. 101 things you thought you knew about the Titanic, but didn't. And it has to be said that Tim doesn't realise this, but I snuck in to see his Lincoln piece, actually, because I was doing, I was hosting the session afterwards, and I thought, I just want to see how Tim performs. My goodness me, in Lincoln, he just captured that crowd. He didn't let them go. It was a tour de force of quality presentation from an author who's done more than magnificent research. We say the magical words, Tim Moulton. Are you there, Tim?
Good afternoon, everyone.
Hello, Tim.
Hi, Tim.
Delighted to have you back on board. And first off, yes, congratulations on a fantastic time at Lincoln. Did you enjoy the whole Lincoln literary experience? In other words, did Sarah Bullimore and David Lambert, did we look after you appropriately?
Yes, very well indeed. It was great fun, but it does seem strange to be talking about a disaster after such a great England result just now.
Yeah. Exactly, but isn't that so much in keeping with the national temperament? Budget yesterday, win today. Fantastic, you know? That's what
Yes, absolutely. And I think we like our disasters as well as our victories sometimes.
Yeah, precisely so. Anyway, Joy normally does lots of key research in terms of things like this, and I put a hyperlink into the whole running order for this, as you say, looking ahead to Monday the 5th of July, which you'll be pleased to know doesn't clash with any England games, I don't think, as far as we're well sorted through on that. So, Joy, have you managed to do some research with Tim and his work, 101 Things You Thought You Knew About the Titanic But Didn't?
You see, the thing is, Tim, I don't think I even know 101 things about the Titanic, let alone thought I knew them, but I don't. I don't know anything.
You'd be surprised, actually. I mean, you've probably seen the James Cameron film, have you?
Oh, I don't really want to have to admit that on
live air. Oh, come on.
So in that case, you probably know 10,000 things about the Titanic, but I've just focused on 101 of the things that are most commonly got wrong about the ship.
Ooh, sounds fascinating.
What's the most common thing that's got wrong, Tim?
Well, I think that one of the strangest things is that Captain Smith actually was, in fact, accident-prone. He was the best captain, of course, on the North Atlantic, but actually the Titanic was twice the size of any class of ship that had appeared on the world stage previously, and in fact Smith's previous command was only half the size of the Titanic, and he managed to have a small accident with the Titanic in New York. The Titanic nearly had a collision as it left Southampton on its maiden voyage, and in fact just between those two incidents, there was an enormous collision between the Olympic, which is Titanic's sister ship, and Captain Smith. So he was very, very good captain, but no one understood the hydrodynamic forces that such a huge hull would produce.
Yes, a very good captain, but obviously hopeless at sea. Good on paper, you know, rubbish at sea. Yes, yeah. Very good.
But all those things that everybody thinks are true, Tim, like, you know, the band playing while the ship went down and the fact that steerage passengers were locked in until the first class had gone, all that's true, is it?
Well, no, particularly I'll pick you up on the third class one, in fact. Much is made of the locked gates and things like that, which feature in the Cameron film. In fact, those gates were not locked. They were just closed and manned by quartermasters. And they were manned by law because you were not allowed to have openness between the steerage class, as the third was called in those days, and the other classes because of immigration laws to stop the spread of infectious diseases. And what's interesting is that as soon as the Titanic knew she was doomed, and that was not until 12:30, about an hour after the collision, these barriers were put up and opened, and in fact stewards from all classes were sent to third class to direct people to the boats.
Is it true that a lot of the boats were launched with only sort of half the right number of people in them?
Yes, that's right. In fact, despite the fact that the Titanic didn't have enough lifeboats, in fact, one out of the three places in each boat went empty. And that's really because there were not enough crew on the Titanic to launch all the boats sufficiently. For example, although one boat was launched every 4 minutes, there was a period of 20 minutes when none of the 8 stern boats were being launched at all. And again, when the stern boats were being launched, none of the forward boats were being launched.
Just shows that 100 or so years ago, we still had the total, complete faith in our lords and masters that we do today. Really, it's fantastic. The other thing which I thought was fascinating from the talk was your notion, Tim, that actually, if they hadn't tried to steer around the iceberg, if they ploughed on through it, they probably would have survived.
That's right. This is something which the designers of the Titanic, who was not on the ship and therefore survived, he was asked at the British Inquiry after the disaster, and he explained that if the Titanic had hit the iceberg head-on, she would have crumbled up her first 100 feet, but travelling at only 22 knots, she would have pulled up to zero over 100 feet. And, of course, a motor car travelling that speed could do the same under braking without throwing its passengers out of their seats even.
Just goes to show, if only Anne tried to avoid it, just goes straight for the whole thing.
Yeah.
It was interesting, because originally I think it was reported that there were actually no deaths from the Titanic on the first newspaper report after the incident. Is that right, Tim?
Yes, the Titanic was regarded as a lifeboat in herself. Her watertight subdivision was so good that she was actually allowed by the Board of Trade to not carry enough lifeboats for everyone. And so it was pretty impossible to people that she could sink. And this was because even the designer and the captain of the Titanic, even on the voyage, on the fateful voyage on the Titanic, were telling passengers that the Titanic could be cut crosswise into three pieces and that each separate piece would float. Well, that was actually true. However, what they didn't envisage was a freak sideswipe disaster where, in fact, the Titanic's hull was very slightly damaged across 300 feet of her, which actually meant that 6 of her watertight compartments failed. And this sort of damage was never envisaged in the sense of if there was a collision or something, it would never cause that sort of damage. And in fact, this such a freak accident had never occurred before, and it has never occurred since.
Mm. Oh, that's a shame. So, Tim, in your research, have you met any of the descendants of survivors from it?
Was that a
have
yes?
I met any? Yes. Yes. Sorry. If I've met, what would I do, or have I met? I've met, really, actually, I've met Milverna Dean before she died. She was only a baby on the ship, so she doesn't remember it firsthand. But interestingly, following the writing of the book, Thomas Andrews's great-nephew came forward and said that, he was sure that Thomas Andrews, the designer on board, wasn't actually trying to delay the distress message going out. Because I point out in the book that the distress signal was not sent from Titanic until 47 minutes after the collision. And, of course, I was able to agree with him totally and say that it simply took that long to get all the data together, to look at how fast the water was rising, to look at the blueprints on the ship, and then to convince the owner, Bruce Ismay, who was also on board, that, in fact, a CQD or SOS signal simply had to be sent out.
Tim, is it true that Bruce Ismay disguised himself as a woman in order to get on one of the lifeboats?
No, it's not true.
Oh, what a shame.
But there is a female disguise story in the sense that one person freely admitted, Daniel Buckley, freely admitted that he had worn a shawl over his head to disguise himself as a woman in order to get into the lifeboats without being spotted. But he admitted that freely. In fact, Bruce Ismay was acting as crew to hold back passengers when one of the last collapsible boats was launched. And in fact, right at the last minute, he switched from acting like crew to being able to be a passenger, and he was technically travelling as a passenger and was able to just step into an empty place in the boat as it was being lowered.
Oh, no, that's cool. That is slick, isn't it? Yeah. That's you call the British stiff upper lip, just because the ship's going down. Yeah. Everybody else, they just say, oh, just step on now then.
But surely the other thing to have done would have been just to grab one last person and put them in and stay behind himself.
You know? I think he always wished he'd done that. His wife said that the Titanic ruined their lives.
Really?
And in fact, he spent the whole time on the rescue ship, the Carpathia, hiding in the doctor's cabin because 57 widows were on that ship and their husbands had gone down when he had survived and he was the owner of the line.
Standard. Oh, that's awful, isn't it?
I mean, in so many ways, it's a tragedy. But at the same time, Tim, I think you bring to us some of the inspiring stories and some of the notions that come out of this. Because the other fact, which, again, without giving too much away, because clearly, if you want to find out more, Monday the 5th of July, Middlesbrough Literary Festival, reference library, well worth catching Tim Moulton with this particular text. But the line that, because of the meteorological conditions on the night, it would have been physically impossible for it not to have actually hit an iceberg at some time.
That's right. I would say it would have been impossible for it not to have hit ice. And that's because it was, in fact, field ice, which stretched all the way from, for about 27 miles, all the way from south of Titanic's track, all the way up to well north of Titanic's track. And, in fact, Titanic was only 7 minutes of steaming away from running into this impenetrable ice barrier through which there was no way around. So she definitely would have collided that night, and she just happened to collide into an outlying berg. But that was one of many, because in the morning, the lifeboats, remember, they stayed on the position where the Titanic went down because their oars were not very effective, and so they more or less stayed exactly where they were. And as the sun came up, Captain Rostron of the rescue vessel, the Carpathia, noticed ice all around the ship. In fact, they counted 45 icebergs, which were more than 200 feet high in the area, and they lost count of the smaller icebergs. So there was ice everywhere that night.
I know when we first spoke, Tim, we both agreed that really we were both heavily influenced by A Night to Remember, which I still think is superior to the James Cameron piece. You know, much as that is fun, you know, but I think Cameron better with Terminator, Aliens, and indeed Avatar than actually dealing with the Titanic. However,
I'm not sure about that. Kenneth Moore's sort of swimming in his polo jumper, swimming now. Don't panic, everybody, don't panic. Yeah. I wasn't quite sure that was realistic, was it?
What's interesting about that film is obviously it was written by Walter Lord, and Walter Lord had communicated, because he was that generation older than all of us, he was able to communicate with 50 survivors in detail who really gave him the first-hand gen of what went on. And then the film was made directly from that book. And also, the fourth officer, the navigating officer on Titanic, Joseph Boxall, he was still alive when the film was made, and he was actually a technical advisor to the film. And interestingly, Captain Smith's daughter, when she went onto the set and saw the person who was playing Captain Smith, it really struck her. She felt she was with her father again.
Ooh, spooky, very spooky.
I mean, so they do get that right, I must say.
I'm just thinking a similar experience occurs every time you're the principal in Hollyoaks, Malcolm. I'm thinking, you taught me, you know, it's all through on that basis. You know, it's crucial from that perspective. Aaron, we'll move the microphone over to yourself. And any questions from yourself that you'd like to throw at Tim? Because I think it's fair enough when we were looking through the Middlesbrough Literary Festival booklet, the Monday the 5th of July gig was one you sort of inked in and say, I shall be there.
Yeah, definitely. Hi, Tim.
Hello.
Hi, I was just wondering, you know, I grew up sort of 12 miles from where the Titanic was built, and I remember my grandparents...
See, we select our guests very crucially on this show, Tim.
Right.
I can remember my grandparents having, discussing it, because this is a subject I really like, and I can remember my grandparents really having a sense of pride in the ship that was built just down the road from them. Do you, you know, and another thing I also like, I'm a big... conspiracy theory as well. I know one of the theories is that maybe it was an insurance job and it was switched for the Olympia. Is that something?
An insurance job? In 1912?
In 1912. What's your take on the people that comes up with these conspiracy theories about the Titanic?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, just two quick questions there. First of all, I'd say that the people of Belfast are rightly very proud of Titanic and Olympic and Britannic, which they built. And, of course, I've explained that it was such a freak accident that brought her down. And many of them, as you will know, just didn't want to speak about it afterwards. It was like a death in the family, really, literally, to all of the people that worked on the ship. But, yeah, the conspiracy theorists really have just got a little bit too much time on their hands, and they really want to sort of invent history. What I think is fascinating about the Titanic is that the truth of the story is stranger than any of the fictions that we're all familiar with about it. And that's what I've tried to bring out here. And certainly the whole switching theory is debunked in the book rather convincingly, as is the sort of no-Pope thing and all this sort of thing. And one good example is people said the Titanic was unlucky because the bottle of champagne didn't break on the bow. Well, in fact, as you might know, as being a Belfast man, Harland and Wolff, the shipyard where she was built, they never, in fact, christened their ships. As one of the yard workers said at the launch, we just build them and shove them in.
Makes sense.
One of the things my granny always saying, because obviously being a Northern Ireland being a very religious place, that they said that the Titanic was unsinkable. Is that historic that they actually did say that?
Yes, not only did they say it, but everybody believed it. It wasn't marketing spin put out by the company. The designers of the Titanic believed that she was unsinkable. And she was, in fact, one of the safest ships that ever put to sea. The safest ship that ever put to sea was the Leviathan, which we now know as the Great Eastern, which was Brunel's ship in the 1850s. But in fact, that was impractical because its bulkheads had no doors in them. So, of course, Titanic had watertight doors in the bulkheads, but she was, apart from the Great Eastern, pretty much the safest ship that was ever made. But unfortunately, she was brought down by a genuinely freak set of circumstances.
It happens, and it obviously provides all manner of wonderful things. Tim, the great frustration for me is that on the same evening as you're talking at the Reference Library in Middlesbrough about 101 things you thought you knew about the Titanic, I'm technically booked for a gig that might be taking part for one of our colleagues here at the University of Lincoln. Oh, I am torn. We can't mention their name because obviously they may be listening. But Joy knows exactly who I'm referring to, and I'm thinking, oh dear, is it? But Aaron, I think, will definitely be there, which is great stuff from there. Joy, any questions from yourself?
No, not at this time.
No, that's okay.
Just,
well,
having a little perusal.
We've got one more from Malcolm then.
I've got one, boss. Just one more question on what's true and what isn't, Tim. When the lifeboats returned to try and pick people up who were in the sea, is it true that A, they returned, B, that they returned too late, and that C, they only pulled four people out?
Okay, 50 people were, in fact, pulled from the water, but only half of those survived because the water was below freezing, in fact, when the Titanic sank, only kept liquid by the movement of the water and the fact that it was salty. And, in fact, not really any lifeboats went back, apart from one, which was Fifth Officer Lowe in lifeboat number 14. But he didn't go back until after the cries had died down about an hour after the ship disappeared. And when he went back, it was too late. They did manage to pull in five people, of which two died. But really, none of the lifeboats went back. And one of the rather basic facts about that, which I think is quite interesting, is that it was a dark night with no moon. And therefore, once Titanic's lights went out, it's pretty impossible to hear where the cries were coming from, because at sea, you can't hear the direction in which cries are coming from. And basically, they couldn't find where the ship was, and people could only swim 200 yards before they were overcome with being frozen.
Good Lord. So it wasn't a question of the people on the boats, people in charge of the lifeboats, thinking they might be swamped if they went back. They just couldn't locate people.
What they were is they were very concerned about suction, and that's why the lifeboats went to a distance which was too far away for swimmers to strike out to. Right. And then once Titanic had gone, they only had a limited period of time to go back and get those people, and the boats were unwieldy, very, very heavy. And, of course, the boats were designed to carry 65 people, but I don't think the Board of Trade took into account that everyone would wear their fur coat over the top of their life jacket, and, in fact, there was no room to swing the oars on the boats.
Isn't it dreadful when, you know, you have to have the old fur coats out? You see, clearly, you know, some kind of alternative weather material should have been made available. Never mind. I mean, we talked about, obviously, other great tragedies like the Hindenburg and I suppose, from this century, 9/11 possibly springs to mind and so on. Do you think that there's something about the Titanic that kind of captures the public imagination? I mean, we mentioned, obviously, the movies, the reference. I mean, you've already captured us from the few moments you've joined us on Siren today, Tim. I mean, is there something we can actually, you know, consciously say, oh, well, that's the reason, that's why we're fascinated?
No, I think we can. can. I mean, I remember, and I'm sure we all remember, when the Twin Towers went down. It's rather like remembering, if you're another generation, when Kennedy was shot. And I think it's summed up rather well by a survivor of the Titanic called Jack Thayer. He was only a boy on the Titanic, and he survived by swimming in the water to an upturned lifeboat. His father died in the disaster, and his mother was saved, and they were reunited on the Carpathia. But he said, he wrote his memoirs in 1940, and looking back, which is crucial because we're now looking back at it, obviously, he said, looking back, the world seemed to have an even tenor to its ways before the Titanic sank, but afterwards it seemed to be a more chaotic world, with the pace moving faster and faster and faster. And that's because Titanic was before the First World War, and I think Titanic for us represents a calm and ordered world, and I think post-Titanic the world is very complicated, and the Twin Towers really embody that as well.
Mm. And of course, 2012, centenary of the sinking of the Titanic, we've got an Olympic Games. Bizarre. Strange,
yeah,
but true.
I think also it was just such a very beautiful ship, and so romantically beautiful in that period. It was very, very elegant and incredibly richly done out, you know. So, and it was the dream voyage for most people. Of the upper class.
That's the other reason. You've picked upon it. That's the other reason why Titanic is so resonates with us, is that you couldn't have written it better if you'd just written it as fiction. She was the biggest and best ship in the world with all the celebrities of the day on board. And in fact, the disaster was predicted 14 years before it happened by a novelist. And it was even the fictional ship was even called the Titan. It sank on its third voyage to New York by hitting an iceberg, and in fact rolling over. So what I'm saying is that person could already bring all those elements together, but what actually happened in reality on the Titanic was even more amazing than the author dared imagine, which was the maiden voyage.
Incredible. She must have been a fortune teller as well as a storyteller.
Yes, he did also predict a number of things. He also predicted the Hiroshima bomb, in fact, before it happened.
Well,
did he say that there'd also be a radio station in Siren in Lincoln called Siren 107.3 broadcasting to the world as well?
Great, yeah.
It's a possibility.
Yeah,
Tim, I think you've actually just rubber-stamped why it is essential to make every effort to make your way to Monday the 5th of July, Middlesbrough Reference Library, to touch base with 101 things you thought you knew about the Titanic but didn't. But just in case people actually want to touch base with you at some other festival, are you doing any other events later on this summer, or will you be on tour? Will it be a case of, no, I'm going to focus now on a whole range of new writing styles?
I am focusing on a couple of other books on the Titanic. One of them is called A Very Deceiving Night, and it focuses on the reason why a ship only 10 miles away from the Titanic did not come to Titanic's aid.
Indeed, and that's another classic which I thought, now I'll leave that as something to actually discover on the night. It's like a wonderful cliffhanger ending, except obviously we're not talking about cliffhangers at sea, because clearly it would be both sides. Anyway, I won't go there. Tim, have you had a reasonably interesting telephonic link with us today on Siren 107.3 FM?
It's been very pleasurable, and I look forward to seeing everyone on the day.
I was just going to say, so can we look forward to hopefully connecting with you on the event itself, and probably telephonically in the not-too-distant future?
I would be delighted to do that. Thank you very much.
Tim Moulton, we salute you.
My name is Malcolm Tomlinson, the new voiceover artist for the Midweek Drive on Siren 107.3 FM.